We're going to be looking today at chapter 6 of 2 Samuel. Understand, Matt got a little ways into that chapter, whatever you think. But this is an important chapter. This is one of those portions of Scripture where a typical American person just kind of shakes his head and says, "What?" But it's important for us. Just because we don't understand something doesn't mean that it isn't important and that we do need to understand it. And what I'm referring to is the cart carrying the Ark of the Covenant is going along, and maybe the Ark is bouncing on it, or the Ark is tipping, or whatever it's doing when it's being pulled, and a guy reaches up to steady things, and he's struck dead by God. Whoa, all right, what do we do with that? All right, well, let's look at the chapter. Let's look at the introduction on the sheet, lesson 16, so we can see a little bit of the structure. The chronicler is always, Hebrew people think this way. Like in poetry, we rhyme words, they rhyme thoughts. In poetry, we have meter. Well, they don't have that, but what they have is structure within. Now, this isn't especially poetry, this chapter, but it's just the way they think. So there's often, and I've tried to point it out as we've gone along, a structure to the chapter that helps us understand what the chronicler wants us to know. Chapter 6, the terror and ecstasy of God. Israelites in David's day were probably not particularly excited over an ancient box, 3¾ by 2¼ by 2¼ feet, made of acacia wood, plated with gold, and called the Ark of the Covenant. And the reason that they probably weren't that excited about it is that the children of Israel hadn't been particularly excited about it for quite a long time. In fact, we often don't know where in the world it was. But now David is going to bring it to his new capital city. He's captured Jerusalem from the Jebusites, who have been independent, if you will, in Israel ever since the days of Joshua. But now it's been conquered, and David is going to make it his capital city. It's a perfect choice. It's a very defensible city, for a lot of different reasons. We'll see that later on. Because it has a secure water supply and it had height, and that's always easy to defend. But also politically it was a good choice because it was in the northern part of the southern kingdom. Whereas if he had chosen Hebron, which is where the tribe of Judah was ruled from, that would have alienated the northern tribes because it was way in the south. So David makes a good choice all the way around. But the Ark of the Covenant has not played a major role in the life of God's people. Remember, they brought it out because they weren't doing too well, and so they brought it out and they lost it, and so God was not happy about that. All right. The Ark of the Covenant had led Israel through the wilderness, brought her across the Jordan River at spring flood stage, so the water stopped flowing, brought down the walls of Jericho simply by being carried around the city, but that was 400 years ago, almost twice the period of time that America has existed. Now, 400 years, that's a long time. During the days of the judges, it had often been ignored in favor of the agricultural gods of the Canaanites. You know, not the gods of the Bedouins out in the desert with their, the tabernacle was a movable place. Now they're in Canaan, and so they're always getting involved with the gods of the local people. You know, they know how to farm. So if you got to worry about whether it's going to rain, you better serve the right gods. And we think to ourselves, all those pitiful people, you know, worshiping false gods. We would never think about doing that. No, we wouldn't. We don't worship false gods. We worship things like money and power and what other people think of us. Yeah, things that ancient people would have said, well, they're not gods. They would have laughed at us, you know. No different for us than for the children of Israel. Yes.
It's really interesting because I went back to Minnesota, and these farmers, the large soybean and corn farmers, they mm-hmm. store this soybean and corn up, and they worship the computer. They watch that computer, watch the market go up and do it, so they know when to sell it.
Yeah. Well, it may not be too bad to figure out when to sell it, but it can become. Yeah. Okay, right. All right, we're getting an idea. We might well have shared their lack of excitement had we been an Israelite in the days of David's reign. But David is excited about this. Your apathy might be shaken, however, once you realize that this piece of sacred furniture represents the very presence of the Lord among his people. Well, why didn't he do that then before? Why didn't he do something? Well, okay, why not? That's a hard question to answer because the answer is we have no idea. And who are we to tell God what he ought to do and when he should do it? So for a long time, this thing is not going well. But now the children of Israel, under the leadership of David, are saying, look, we need to do this. We need to honor the presence of God among us, the Ark. We're going to talk about what the Ark of the Covenant was so that you understand that a little bit better. So just wait. We'll do that today. If you realize that this piece of sacred furniture represents the very presence of the Lord among his people, how is God among his people in the greatest manifestation of his presence? It isn't the Ark of the Covenant. What is the greatest manifestation or showing forth of God's glory and salvation on the earth in history?
Jesus Christ.
Jesus, right. Jesus is the Ark of the Covenant, as you'll see in just a little while. I mean, he's not literally the Ark of the Covenant, but the Ark of the Covenant represents Christ among the people of Israel. So this story about the Ark in 2 Samuel 6 should matter to you, for this is no travelogue of the Ark of the Covenant, but a revelation of the God of Israel. I picked up a t-shirt that was from some kind of vodka, and it had a saying. Does anyone know what the saying is? This is not good. That's good.
You don't know the sayings of the vodka.
I'm encouraged. Right. The saying is, be afraid. Be very afraid. Okay? That's a good one. You don't know that, that's good, but remember that. Okay.
Do we need to learn them?
No. You can forget that after this chapter is over. All right. Consider the structure the chronicler gives this story of the Ark of the Lord. So in verses 2 and 4, we see bringing up the Ark. In verses 12 and 13, we're bringing up the Ark. We're seeing the structure. So in verse 5, there's joy. In verse 14 and 15, there's joy. In verse 6 and 7, there's tragedy. In verse 16, there's tragedy. David's reaction is anger and fear first, then it's worship and generosity. And in the house of Obed-Edom, where the ark was taken, blessing. In the house of David, contempt. So, you know, you kind of just see the story. All right, let's look at the first verses of chapter 6. David again brought together out of Israel chosen men, 30,000 in all. He and all his men sent out from Baalah of Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim that are on the ark. What do you think of that? I mean, what's your reaction? Is that a good thing?
Good plan. He'd show his men he would trust to do the right job, too.
Okay, and he chose a lot of them,
yeah,
too, didn't he? Yeah, okay, yeah.
Well, he must have also been aware of the many, many years it was at Abinadab's place that blessings happened. So with the ark comes blessings.
Yeah, okay, with the ark comes blessing. So David's going to establish his capital city, and he wants to bring the Ark of the Covenant. Of course, with it comes the tabernacle. We have no real idea what kind of shape the tabernacle was. It's 400 years old, and it's a portable building. You know, so we just don't know what its condition is at all. These verses are a disaster. They're a complete disaster. Why?
They ignored it for so long.
Well, but that's the past. This is a disaster. Yes.
Well, last week we talked about how it was supposed to be carried.
Carried. That's right.
Yeah.
Did David figure out what he should do with this ark that is the symbol of the Lord's presence? No. He figures it out. He gets 30,000 of his best people. We're going to have a celebration, and his motives are good in the sense that he wants to bring the ark up. But be afraid, be very afraid. Yes.
Well, it seemed like before he would go into battles were very important to him, and he would always confer with the Lord. Mm-hmm. And I'm thinking that maybe his mindset wasn't of the same reverence with having to do this as it was when he was going into battle, so he never really conferred with the Lord before he made the decision to take the ark.
Well, it doesn't tell us that. He certainly didn't confer with the Word of God, did he, to figure it out. Now, I don't think we have to find fault here with David. The chronicler doesn't blame him at all. He just tells us what happened. And we're kind of shocked. I mean, if you've looked at it, you get some sort of sense. But you're kind of shocked that in the midst of this, bringing this ark up, this tragedy happens. What we're trying to figure out here, and what David needed to figure out, is a little bit about God. And let's think of some pictures about God. The Good Shepherd, for example. A father, a loving father. You can think of a protector. I mean, there's all kinds of pictures of God that you can think about and remember from the Scripture. How did Luther begin the explanation of every commandment?
We should fear and love God.
We're not especially comfortable with this fear, but be afraid. Be very afraid. Because we are sinful people, and when God is in your midst, you better be very careful. They should have learned from history. Remember when the tabernacle was first built, Aaron's sons said, "Oh, whoa, we're going to be the high priests of God. We're going to stand before the Lord and represent the people." So they got together and decided, well, let's try this out, you know. They got to the outer door and they died. And Aaron was stricken. His two sons died, and God said to Aaron, "Suck it up and take care of your responsibilities. Be the high priest and don't mourn your sons." Okay, be afraid. Be very afraid.
Pastor,
yes?
Pastor, you said that David, there was no blame on David for this. But didn't David know that he wasn't supposed to?
Well, maybe he should have known. I didn't say there's no blame. I said we don't have to make David a bad guy.
That's not what you said.
Yeah, that's what I said. We don't have to find blame for David. We don't have to blame him. Make him a bad guy. So now God's getting even with him. Because I don't know that we would have been any different. Is there blame for him? Yes.
He should have figured it out, and he didn't. But it hadn't been done for 400 years. Well, maybe 300 years, let's say. I don't know.
Yeah, but because I would think that he would know how God wanted that to be carried.
Well, they haven't been carrying it for 400 years. And they carried it into battle, and no one was stricken. And you could say, well, why? Although, when they carried it into the battle, the priests carried it.
The Levite.
Well, there's no distinction. The priests come from the tribe of Levi. But the point isn't whether he's got blame or not. The point is, we read this and we don't get it. Why is this terrible thing? Well, let's read a little further. Go to the guide. Let's read some of the things that are there. So, background, just for the first two verses. The city of Baalah in Judah, also known as Kiriath Jearim, and we know that name better from the chronicler, was bursting at the seams with 30,000 chosen men and probably all kinds of other people who would accompany the Ark of the Covenant on its journey to Jerusalem. Significant event. Before we leave for the holy city, let's consider what this ark represents. Moses prayed thusly when the ark moved on the journey through the wilderness. Whenever the ark set out, Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord. May your enemies be scattered. May your foes flee before you." Whenever it came to rest, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the countless thousands of Israel." So the Ark of the Covenant represented God. That's from Numbers. The Ark was so closely identified with the Lord that whenever it set out, Moses said, "Rise up, O Lord," and whenever it came to rest, he said, "Return, O Lord, to the thousands of Israel." The Ark was the sacrament of the Lord's presence in the Old Testament. What is a sacrament? Confirmation class, come on.
A sacrament
is a...
It's an element.
No, that's one of the things. A sacrament is a sacred act which...
Instituted by God.
Instituted by, well, in the New Testament we say by Christ, but instituted by God.
That's forgiveness of sin.
It grants the forgiveness of sins.
It has an earthly element.
And it has an earthly element. The ark is a sacrament. It was created by God. What was on the top of the ark? Yeah, right. But yeah. But that's not forgiveness, is it? That's more of the glory of the Lord.
The mercy seat.
The mercy seat. The place where the priest sprinkled blood. The mercy seat, and the ark is the throne of God. So where the very presence of God in all of his glory is, there is his forgiveness, but they are inseparable. Be afraid, be very afraid, and rejoice. So if this box of gold-plated acacia wood signifies the Lord's presence, what sort of God is present? First, the ark speaks of the Lord's rulership. How? It speaks of his being king because it's a
throne.
It's a throne. That's what it is. It's a throne. Okay, so it speaks of God's rulership. Second, it underscores the Lord's reconciliation with sinful people. How? Pat. Repeat the answer.
He shows his mercy by being merciful.
Well, but the ark...
The mercy seat.
Yeah, the ark is the mercy seat. So how does the ark show God's forgiveness? It is the mercy seat, all right? Third, it emphasizes the Lord's revelation. We haven't talked about that. How does it show the Lord's revelation? Yes?
Wouldn't the tablets, the Exactly.
Brought down from the mountain.
Wait, the tablets are the
Ten Commandments.
Yes, the Ten Commandments are on them, but the tablets are the covenant that God made with His people. And so they are the way that the Lord relates to His people. Revelation. Okay? All the hubbub in Kiriath-Jearim really matters then. This is very important. By bringing the Ark to Zion, David is saying that the Lord's presence cannot remain on a side rail. So that's a good move by David, but must be the central focus and reality of the Davidic kingdom. We're coming up, the next chapter is God making the promise of this Davidic kingdom that's going to last forever. That's the next chapter. So the worship of the Lord, this ruling, reconciling, revealing God must be at the heart of Israel's life. The Ark of the Covenant proclaims that the majestic, pardoning, speaking God is in the midst of His people. Two footnotes. In chapter 5, we see David and Israel whipping the Jebusites and especially the Philistines. But chapter 6 says that such victories are not nearly as important as having the Ark of the Covenant, the physical symbol of the Lord's presence. That has always been the way God has revealed Himself, even before the fall into sin. How did God reveal Himself physically?
Burning bush?
No, that's after the fall.
Well, He walked with the...
That was also after the fall, although He may have walked with them, but that's kind of a guess.
Before the fall?
Before the fall. How did God physically show
the cloud to fire?
Is that the tree?
Yes.
Not singular.
Trees of
the trees.
The tree of life and the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
If you want somebody to... The tree of life, that makes sense. You could pick the fruit and eat it, it gives you life. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil? You eat the fruit and you know good and evil? That's bizarre to our thinking. But you see, God comes to us physically. He doesn't require us to become spiritual and understand Him. He comes to us where we are. He has always done this. And this Ark of the Covenant is the probably what's it's the together with the tabernacle and the temple that is going to be built by David's son. This is the heart of the Old Testament covenant. So also, how is the threefold office of Christ the fulfillment of all that the Ark of the Covenant signifies? What is the threefold office of Christ? Yes.
King.
Prophet. What do prophets do? They speak. They foretell in the sense that they stand in front of someone and tell what they're going to tell. Because they often told the future, we get too stuck with that one thing. They speak. Okay? What does a king do?
Rules.
King rules. What does a priest do?
Intercede.
Yeah, intercedes is a go-between. Reconciling. Okay, so you see the function of the Ark is the same as the function of the offices of the Old Testament, prophet, priest, and king, which are fulfilled in Jesus Christ. The Ark is Christ. It's God among His people before Jesus becomes flesh and one of us. All right, let's see what happened. Beginning with verse 3. They set the Ark of God on a new cart. Well, that's a good idea, isn't it? Huh? A new cart? Yeah. You put the poles through and they carry it. But David's... Okay. And brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, nice folks, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it. And the Hebrew is a little difficult there, but not the gist, we figured it out. And Ahio was walking in front of it. David and the whole house of Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with songs and with harps, lyres, tambourines, sistrums, and cymbals, all kinds of instruments. When they came to the threshold floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the ark of God because the oxen stumbled. Now again, what exactly happened? Well, you can guess. It doesn't make any difference. They're coming down a hill, and so maybe the oxen start to slip, and it looks like the cart's going to go over something, whatever. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the ark of God. Be afraid. Be very afraid. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah, and to this day that place is called Perez Uzzah, outbreak against Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day. Ooh, that's a good development. it might have been better if it had started earlier in the day, but he's afraid. And he's upset with God. How can the ark of the Lord ever come to me? What have I done that's wrong? How are we going to ever get the ark of the covenant? And you see where David is coming from. He was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. So now he's having a snit. And he's saying, we can't get the ark there, so I've got to give up on this. Yes.
What Uzzah did, it's called irreverent. So was he? Is this a naive sort of thing he did, or... Why do they call it irreverent?
Well, the problem here is that we've got to figure out blame. Uzzah can't be struck down by the Lord unless he deserves it. And in our mind, if your motive is correct, then you shouldn't be suffering for it. So clearly, there's nothing in the text that indicates that he had an evil motive. It's going to fall over. He doesn't want that to happen. But the whole thing was wrong. This is the beginning. See, it's very important, excuse me, for this to have a good beginning. David is bringing the ark up, but he's not doing it right. And then when he isn't doing it right and this terrible thing happens, he's angry with the Lord and he decides, well, you know, the Lord doesn't want me to bring it to Jerusalem when there's no indication of that whatsoever. Yes.
Thank you. Our mindset is the end justifies the means. So we want to get the covenant to, or the ark to Jerusalem. Any way you get it there is okay, because the object is to get it to Jerusalem. And how you get there, we don't look at it being bad.
And of course, what we have to be doing right now is figuring out what this story means to us. We're not dealing with the ark.
Yeah.
And our relationship with the Lord is different than it was in the days of the Old Testament. Louisa.
This reminds me of a lot of Christian churches that often stray from the Word because their motives are good, because maybe they want to sugarcoat some of it to bring more people to hear God's Word, but they're not really listening to God's Word.
Many Christian parents do this with teenagers. Teenagers start to get cranky because you get cranky as you get older, and the older you get, the crankier. And so they start to sugarcoat. You know, well, you know, you don't have to go to church if you don't really want to, because I don't want to make my children go to church. No, that's not right.
Well, yeah, okay. So we're beginning, yes.
Well, I think this is a lesson in obedience that God, yeah, chroniclers telling us, because even though he struck Uzziah, but he also struck David at the same time. This whole event, David put the thing on the cart.
Oh, yeah.
And Uzziah touched it. I mean, the Lord's saying, you know, I know this has been 400 years, guys, but we better get back to what you should be knowing, the obedient. You obey me. Do what I tell you. And this is a lesson.
But see, don't mess. Yes, we want the Lord to receive, I think, Luis's point, or whoever said the end justifies me. That was maybe. You know, we have good motives, and therefore whatever we do will suit. And we need to realize that we have to be afraid of the Lord, and we have to teach that. We should fear and love God, that we do not curse, swear, practice superstition, lie, or deceive by his name. And it keeps on going. We should fear and love God. When will fear disappear? It's a trick question.
Christ comes back.
No?
For me, when I first really read it, I was like, yeah, wait a minute. Okay, now what? I'm not quite, okay, why did this happen? Okay, but if in the Bible there's a reason for me to know. So my first reaction was, okay, I've got to read more. I've got to read more of the references to see why this happened, what it was that happened. So to me, I think whenever I see things in the Bible that I don't necessarily think, in my mind, my human mind, that it's right, or that it's right the way it's given, I go into other parts of the Bible and I look at other things so that I can get the right frame of mind and understand that God is mighty. And yeah, I do have to be afraid of him.
And that's the way we need to look at things. We can't say, well, this is the 21st century, you know, so we don't look at things the way they did back then. We need to look at things the way the Lord looks at them, not the way we particularly think that it's appropriate to look at them.
Yeah.
Well, one thing at a time.
I'm just going to say, for us, we have the whole Word. We have the Old Testament and the New Testament, which makes it even more for us to go and search out.
Yeah. Well, that makes it easier, doesn't it? But it's also important for us to see the story as it is in the Old Testament and not use the New Testament to blunt it. God isn't like that. This is the God of the Old Testament. The God of the New Testament isn't like that. You can walk all over the God of the New Testament. He doesn't mind.
You will meet Christians who play down the Old Testament. And whenever you see that, run, don't walk. Anybody who's playing down the Old Testament is missing the boat big time. There's only one God, and there's only one scripture, and it all fits. And as you're saying, you just need to figure it out. And some things we don't necessarily figure out either. I mean, this is God, and so some things remain. The word mystery, at the foundation of every Christian, every main Christian doctrine of salvation, is a mystery. When you get right down to it, it's something that has to be revealed to us by God, not something that you can figure out. Yes?
Were even the priests ever allowed to touch the ark? Is that why the poles went through?
I don't know. I would guess no. No one was allowed to go into the Holy of Holies. Right. So when they moved the ark, they took it apart from the outside. And when the Holy of Holies was gone, and it's not described in detail how they took it apart, but they took it apart, excuse me, then I would think they put the poles in and they picked up this thing way big time. And the whole cover was gold. The cherubim above it were solid gold. In the Ark of the Covenant, I mean in the Raiders of the Lost Ark, they had the cherubim with kind of stylized wings straight across. That's because there are things discovered in clay tablets that make it look like that, rather than elaborate high arching wings. So we simply don't know. We don't know. Solid gold, though.
Okay, back to Isaiah.
Yeah.
Even though he may not have known about the rule about carrying the ark a certain way, it's still considered an irreverent act.
Don't mess with God. See, we don't have to have him evil.
But he wasn't messing with him. He just didn't know. Yeah.
Well, yeah. But you see, that's what Aaron would have said about his sons.
Lord, they really didn't know. Give them a break. Well, they need, what you have to get from this is that you better be very afraid of the Lord. Don't mess around. And nothing has changed. The gospel is still as precious as it ever was. And like Louisa was talking about, don't sugarcoat it. Don't go along with anything and everything. The thing is that in the new covenant, judgment is not likely to come immediately like this. Not that we know that it won't, but that's the experience. God generally doesn't strike people down with lightning in the New Testament. But judgment day is going to be very, very difficult.
But the responsibility lay with whoever didn't tell him, didn't explain that to him.
Well, lay with him too. You see, we have got to have blame, don't we? Well, God is telling the children of Israel, you better be very, very careful. And is in some sense Uzzah an innocent victim of his lack of knowledge or of David as the leader? And clearly David understands that the blame lay with him. That's why he's so unhappy. Yes.
Well, in Numbers 4:15, it specifically says, you touch the ark, you die.
Yeah, right.
nobody touches the Ark of the Covenant.
Right. All right, so that's a good point. Okay.
Pastor.
Yes,
I think
Matt.
It's easy to understand in the sense of ignorance of the law does not excuse you. And just like nature has its own laws of gravity and aerodynamics and fluid dynamics, just because we touch something or do something doesn't excuse you or make you suddenly immortal. And as we discover things and as we develop our technology, you touch electricity, it shocks you, you die. That's the way it was designed, that's the way it works.
And so you better be really careful with God. Be afraid, be very afraid.
Pastor?
Yes. Yes, Greg.
In using the words afraid and fear, I was taught that there's a difference between the two, and I hear
that's bordering on false doctrine. I was taught the same thing, that you're not really afraid of God, you're in awe of him. If God appeared in this room, what you would be feeling is fear, and you might call it awe, but it's going to be fear. I learned that same thing, and the more I read the scripture, the more I realize that doesn't make it, and Luther understood that. We shouldn't stand in awe and love God. We should fear and love God. And when the angel said, do not be afraid, where is this word used to mean something that does not mean fear? Is awe a part of it? Certainly, the angels stand in awe of the Lord. But the word isn't awe. There is a word for awe. The word is fear. Don't be afraid, or fear. You know, be afraid. Be very afraid. We can't. We've gotten too casual, and we need to be careful. You grow up when you're a kid. You listen. You believe whatever you're told. You get a little older, and you're not afraid of God.
To answer your question earlier, I think the fear is something that will always be there.
In heaven, too. There will be no time when there is no fear of God. Because in Revelation, it talks about the angels being afraid of God in eternity.
Do you know where that is, Robin?
No, I can't. I have to look that up. If you can go on a computer program, you can just look up fear. Yes.
So the question isn't that we're going to stop fearing God, it's that we're going to know his love more clearly.
Yeah, I don't even know how to say it. You're not going to stop fearing God. Okay. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and that is not going to halt with Judgment Day.
I have a difficulty not explaining it to people that have come in, and they don't like it in our memory course that we say that we should fear and love God that we, and so on. And I've had people coming from other churches saying, I was taught my whole life to be afraid of God, and I think that's wrong.
Well, the answer is that's not wrong. You just weren't taught enough.
Right. And so I think what I'm trying to say, though, is that there's a balance.
Well, there's more than a balance, Mr. Walker. It's when people say I was taught all of my life to fear the Lord, the problem is that they weren't taught to understand God's love and forgiveness. And therefore, they don't... Yeah, balance is a good word. I'll agree. There's no balance there. You're not seeing everything that God reveals. But getting rid of fear and telling people, well, you don't have to be afraid of God. Would you want to stand next to God and say to people, you don't have to be afraid of this guy? I have a brother-in-law that I would meet, you know, like some distance separates you, and he wasn't a Christian, and isn't a Christian, and we would be, and he always wanted to talk religion. That's pastor here now, and he would always talk about the big guy. You know, finally I said to him, you know what, Rich, you don't know him well enough to call him the big guy. That's for the man upstairs, you know. Just refer to him as the Lord, would you please? And he didn't, again, say the big guy around me. That's the kind of thing, you know, if you have a country and Western religion, you know, there's problems there, you know. My dog died, my wife left me, my truck broke down. Things are sad, you know. And but God is our friend. And that's it, you know. So it's understanding God is tough. This is really hard stuff. Do people really expect that the creator of the world, getting to know the creator of the world when you're sinful, is going to be easy? It's hard for God. It was so hard for God that the only way he could do it was to come into the world, become a human being, and come under the condemnation of sin. That's how difficult it is. So we want it to be easy, you know.
Well, it's just the opposite with love. We don't like the idea of forgiving somebody 70 times 7. It's the God's way. God's agape love is different than how we live in love. We don't like that idea of doing that.
So this is hard stuff.
Yeah.
This is hard stuff. That's what this chapter is about. This is hard stuff. And you don't like the fact that Uzzah died. And was he at fault, you know, or was he an innocent victim? I don't know if I want to characterize that. Yes.
So I was looking for Dave's Revelations passage and came across 1 John 4, where it says, God is love, and then it says, there is no fear in love, but perfect love drives out fear, because fear has to do with punishment. The one who fears is not made perfect in love. So.
But that's talking about where?
About where what?
Where is that? Where is John talking about? Where does that take place, everything that he says?
Love being made complete.
No. Where is this? What's he talking about? When? You're making it too difficult. He's talking about now.
Right.
Okay, well, we're talking about heaven.
Okay.
And it's true that perfect love drives out fear. But that doesn't mean there is no fear. The angels fear the Lord, and they are perfect.
And who has perfect love.
So what you have is something that's very difficult to understand. You're not going to get neat categories, because there are categories. They're not God's categories.
And so it's not going to be easy. And so we pass over this chapter. Well, I don't know what to do about Uzzah, but let's keep on going. Yeah, sorry, Greg.
It makes me wonder where God sends Uzzah's soul.
The answer is? Don't know, exactly. That's not the point of the story. We want to dodge the point of the story is, be afraid. Be very afraid. And that's the point of the story. I mean, clearly, that's the point of the story. Okay, let's keep on going. It stayed there for 3 months, and the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and his entire household. Well, gee, he kills Uzzah and he blesses Obed. Now King David was told, the Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the Ark of God. Now remember, David's had his snit. You know, well, I can't bring it up. You know, what am I going to do? Let's see. He was not willing, verse 10, he was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David because it can't come on my terms the way I want it to come. So, I'm not going to bring it. Well, Obed-Edom is getting all of his blessing. So David went down and brought up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, now we'll assume that the right people are carrying it, doesn't say. He sacrificed a bull. They took 6 steps. He sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. David, wearing a linen ephod, danced before the Lord with all his might, while he and the entire house of Israel brought up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. And the tense of the Hebrew word is, it sounds like every 6 steps they sacrificed an animal. Hoping that no one would die. As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, that's the next part, okay? Let's take a look at the danger of the Lord's holiness. Let's think about this. It was fun. It was loud. It was religious. Dancing and singing with lyres, tambourines, cymbals, and so on. Kiriath Jearim was rocking. It just reminds me of people not having a sense of reverence in worship. You know, you can do whatever you want. If you really like this music and it makes you feel good, then do it, because it's all about
me.
Yeah, you. It's all about you. When instead we're doing things that aren't appropriate, and we know that they're not. The ark was traveling on a new cart, but we're still back with verse 3 here. Pulled by oxen with Ahio and Uzzah serving as attendants. A strange thing happened near the threshing floor of Nacon. It took a moment for everyone to realize it. The dancing stopped, the music quieted, all eyes turned to Uzzah, misspelled there, on the ground, writhing, twitching, then still. Someone called 911, the party was over. Well, you try and make it realize that we're part of this. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Does this offend you? Answer, yes. If we're honest, we're offended by this. Now, maybe we're figuring this out and get a little better understanding, but it offends us. It did David. After all, Uzzah was only trying to help. Was he supposed to allow the oxen to bounce the ark right off the cart, or whatever was happening was tipping? Why didn't the Lord cut him some slack? Why so severe, so arbitrary? Arbitrary, because all the time before, the ark had been kind of ignored, and thunder and lightning wasn't coming down on Israel. Now David is going to do a good thing, and Uzzah died. We should be angry along with David, shouldn't we? Or should we be afraid? Very afraid. Passages like this are evidence of the supernatural origin and trustworthiness of the Bible. This Uzzah story goes so against the grain of human preferences. We would never have invented a God like this. Not if we want to win converts and influence people. Don't introduce this God to him. Holy mackerel, that you're not going to get anywhere with people this way. This God is not very marketable. Anyone who says the God of the Bible is merely a projection of our wishes and desires has not read the Bible.
This is not a projection of our wishes and desires. I was offended up on 80 the past holiday season. Big, huge billboard. You know, a standard big size billboard up there on 80 by from Adventure Church, advertising the Christmas service with elves.
Santa Claus.
Santa Claus, yeah. And the only mention of Christ is in the word Christmas. You know.
The radio ads are the same way.
Yeah. Unbelievable. What are these people thinking? It's a good thing the ark isn't around. Yeah.
Well, we had a discussion in my leadership meeting because I'm the secretary and I take the notes. And they were talking about Santa Claus and what do they tell their kids about Santa Claus and stuff like that. And I said, when I became a Wisconsin evangelical Lutheran, the first thing I did was I told my kids there's no Santa Claus.
Oh boy, and I'm not going to Wisconsin.
and the next lady, she said, one of the ladies over there, she said, you teach Sunday school, right? I go, yeah. And she goes, well, what do you teach your kids about Santa Claus at Sunday school? And I said, where does Santa Claus have anything to do with Sunday school?
See, there's the answer. Now, people will ask me, did I tell my children there is no Santa Claus? The answer is no. I never did. They always knew that there was a difference between the story of Jesus in the manger and Santa. And our daughter would say, well, are we going to put out cookies? I said, you want to put out cookies? You can put out cookies. You know, and then a little time goes by, and I always like cookies. They knew that story was not real. They knew it when they were two. And so I didn't feel it necessary to tell them that there is no Santa, and that they should go to school and tell everybody there is no Santa, you know, or something like that. So, all right.
Okay, well, let's see here.
Back to the text. What was the problem, the error here? We have to go back to the days when the Lord first gave his instructions, so Numbers 4, Paul was referring to, about moving the Ark of the Covenant on the way to the Promised Land. What were the rules? The rules were nobody touches it. How is the Lord's action described in verse 8? Now compare that to chapter 5, verse 20. In 5, verse 20, the Lord breaks out against David's enemies. This is a dangerous God. Boy, if you're a Philistine, you better watch out. Because God may break out against you, but it doesn't make any difference who you are. You better be careful, be afraid, be very afraid. In 6:8, he breaks out against David's friend. The Lord may break out against the Philistines or Israel. God's lethal holiness levels both pagans and Christians. And we're just going to have to deal with it. And smoothing it over is not the answer. Of course, as readers, we can continue to object if we like. But the application of the text is clear. You dare not trifle with a God who is both real and holy. And we trifle with God all the time. We teach our children that they don't have to take God seriously. Because I don't want to tell you something you don't want to hear. You may not like me. You know? So we got people who can't be parents anymore. Because they can't tell their children, stop crying. And if you don't stop crying, you're going to wish you had. But that's not nice. You know, that's not nice. All right. So you dare not trifle with a God who is both real and holy. The Lord is not your neat, warm, fuzzy friend in the sky, the man upstairs, the big guy. There is a story from the days of the Civil War. It's in an interesting book. About two men making their way to a reception on a drippy Washington, D.C. evening. The one offered to share the shelter of his umbrella with a stranger on the way to the same affair. As they sloshed along and conversed, the stranger declared his opinion that General Grant was highly overrated. Well, that was a big thing of discussion during the days of the Civil War. You know, who's going to be the general, and what's Lincoln going to do, and so forth. naturally, he wouldn't have said that had he known that Grant was holding the umbrella over him. He acted foolishly because he did not know with whom he was dealing. Now, it's an interesting story, but the only point is you better know with whom you are dealing. And the Lord's people tend to forget what sort of God they face.
God's people tend to forget this. We forget that there is heat in His holiness. No, we do not need to be terrified, but being scared wouldn't hurt. I don't know how to say that. Maybe being terrified is a good thing too. But this is hard to grasp. How am I going to explain this? You know, I can't find the words. Well, do it with your actions then. When you're raising your children, they need to be afraid. Be very afraid. My father's favorite statement was, life as you know it is going to come to an end. and you need that. Children need that. Everybody needs that. They need to know that you can't, even if you're an unbeliever, you don't have anything to do with God at all, still your children, when they grow up, need to know that there's a line that you cannot cross. When children get caught, what do they always say? Why did you do that?
I don't know. Listen, children need to go through life with a line in front of them that goes wherever they go. And when they're with all of their friends and they say, let's do this really stupid thing, they're looking at that line and thinking, you know what, I think I'm getting out of here right now. Because if I cross that line, it's going to be a whole lot worse than what my friends may think about me. And if we don't give them that, then we're failing. Dick, did you have a question?
In Hebrews, it says it's a terrifying thing to fall into the hands of the God.
Yeah. Yeah. And yet we'll talk about being in the loving arms of the Lord. At the heart of every Christian teaching is a mystery. Something that you cannot easily explain. It is tough going. That's, yes.
How do you deal with people who go to, like, mega churches where everything's fuzzy and there's no law, because they are actually coming in contact with some Christianity?
How do I deal with them?
What
they stay very far away from me.
Okay, but I've got a son-in-law,
yeah,
who he's
I know what you're saying. I mean, I'm just thought
he's an ex-Mormon, and he pretty much prevents my grandkids from being in church.
Sometimes so, there isn't anything you can do.
But he was like invited to something for the Halloween thing out there, and I thought, do I say no, or should I say yeah, go? You know, at least it's getting somewhere.
Yeah, well, you know what? We're not responsible for what people do.
Why?
And sometimes we buy everything. We take everything on ourselves.
But should you encourage that, or should you say...
Well, it depends on the circumstances. When you have an opportunity, you know, you have to speak with respect for everyone. You can't just be the person who rides roughshod unless you're a parent. Parents need to ride roughshod. Right. You're going to do this. And you don't have to do this when you're buying your own car insurance and your own health insurance. You get yourself an apartment. You can do whatever you want. But when you're here, this is what you're going to do.
So would you say that's, I mean, there's something positive about that, that at least they're coming in contact?
No, I wouldn't say anything positive about that. I would ignore it. And I would say positive things about the gospel. And I would take every opportunity that I have.
Okay, I just don't know.
The point is, it's very hard. You have to figure out what the best thing to do is. Sometimes the answer is the same. And sometimes the answer is, this is a time to say something, and you have to figure it out. But there certainly are no easy little things that put in the situation. Right. Yeah.
So I understand what you're saying. Right. All right. Well, we'll continue. This is a tough chapter, but we'll move on into chapter 7 next time.